This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
Did the Seahawks make a mistake? They turned the page on a defense, on an all-time great defense. And one of the leading members and one of the guys they chose to part ways with is going to be playing in the Super Bowl and is an all-pro for the San Francisco 49ers. In that question of, did Seattle make a mistake in releasing Richard Sherman? I think is an interesting one. It is important to point out that they let him go with 1 year left on his contract. So even if they hadn't cut him, they would have had to re-sign him last offseason if they wanted to still have him. It doesn't change the fact, though, that you see a number of guys who were ranging from prominent contributors to leaders on this defense. Frank Clark is in the Super Bowl. Earl Thomas was on a 14-2 team. Richard Sherman's in the Super Bowl. And it makes you wonder if Seattle turned the page too quickly.
Yeah, because they could have used him against the Green Bay Packers, that's for sure. And I just wonder about the idea of having that same kind of locker room maybe wouldn't have been great for Russell Wilson, but they were, as you have brought up before, Danny, able to thrive because of the relative unease of the locker room, competition, you could call it. There was some sense of holding each other accountable to an extreme degree that you don't see amongst teams. There's a volatility there, and maybe that lends itself to success. I specifically think they missed him against the Green Bay Packers, and I think that that defense could have used him this year, no matter what kind of yelling he might have been doing at the on the sidelines at some of the guys who might be blowing assignments. So I can understand why, at the same time, people would say, well, yeah, but do you want that for a young team, a leader that maybe doesn't feel that this is going in the right direction? I'm glad you mentioned the contract, though. Because the other thing you have to think about is that, okay, if his contract was to expire, you're talking about a Seahawks team that has significantly less cap space right now and that has a little bit less flexibility with where they go next. It's not necessarily the worst thing in the world if you're talking about a corner that's still playing at a high level, but you have to imagine that Richard Sherman, especially with some of his frustrations here down the stretch, would be asking and negotiating as hard as he possibly can to get a more beneficial deal, perhaps, than the one that he got for himself with the 49ers.
And look, this is always true. You have to pay a guy more to keep him than you do if he gets mad at your offer and will go sign elsewhere. Earl Thomas, when he left and went to Baltimore, there's no guaranteeing. In fact, I think it's really unlikely that he would have accepted the offer that he got from Baltimore from Seattle, because things get all twisted in there. And it's, hey, why didn't you pay me as much as you paid that guy? Hey, you gave this for him. Why am I not getting it? Hey, you're not going to give me a raise on what I was making? Like, what? Things get twisted up. I think it's great to have you as not an outside observer, but someone who has come in and seen where this team is right now. Because we've all who've been in Seattle and followed the team have watched it through from 2014 when they lost that Super Bowl to then 2015 and 2016, where there were some serious sort of identity and questions, and Cam Chancellor's holding out, and Marshawn Lynch is not coming back and retiring, but then ended up going on. There's kind of this transition, and I saw the 2017 season, which is the last season that Richard Sherman played here. It was also the last season Cam Chancellor and Cliff Avril played here. When those guys suffered injuries, and then in Sherman's case was released, in Cam Chancellor's case and Cliff Avril's case, they retired. I felt they had brought that group back and sort of one more year, we're going to get the band back together and see how far we can go. And that question got answered that season because they went 9-7. They tailed off at the end. A lot of guys got hurt and they had to turn the page. And of all of the different players that they've parted ways with, from Richard Sherman to Earl Thomas leaving as a free agent to Michael Bennett being traded to, who am I missing? Doug Baldwin retiring. The decision that I feel strongest was the right one was their decision to release Richard. Because I think that had he stayed here, the weight, and this is even saying his last year he was pretty well behaved. He didn't speak out all that much, but there was a behind the scenes sense that he felt that this team had gone past his prime. This team had missed it. This team had messed up. They'd made decisions. They'd recentered on the quarterback, and they had missed their opportunity to be great. And when there was a story that came out about people referring to the Seahawks as the Titanic, I had no doubt about who was referring to it as the Titanic, and I think they needed to shed that weight.
Good movie. If you look back at that time, you mentioned the injuries at the end of 2017. I think one of the worst parts about a player getting hurt is that they sort of become isolated from the rest of the team. And when you are isolated with your own thoughts, you go down some crazy rabbit holes. Now, if you have a couple of guys that have been here and done that and are watching these players that are behind them on the depth chart try to maintain what you have seen, I can see where those guys, as they sit back and watch, they turn into those two Muppets that are constantly heckling. What are their names?
I've seen this before.
Waldorf. One of them's Waldorf.
Yeah, Waldorf and the other guy. So I can understand how that...
Waldorf and Jim Moore. Those are the two characters that are up there. Because,
you remember when he tried to do this? Yeah, I saw the same thing last week.
And I think that if maybe those injuries hadn't happened, that we could be having a different conversation. How do you feel about that? That if they stayed healthy for all of 2017, and then they actually maybe are able to be around for a potential playoff run, would there have been a possibility of bringing some of those guys back?
Maybe. Maybe you make a decision and make a different decision about Sherman, depending on how that year ends. Cam Chancellor's injury was just a physical breakdown. He was done at that point. But the other part of it that came in is that you kind of learned the lesson that maybe you tried to hold on too long. Because in 2017, that was the feeling of you signed Cam Chancellor to a third contract and extension. You signed Marshawn Lynch to a third contract and extension. You did the same thing for Michael Bennett. And none of those guys were around when the extension years were supposed to kick in. You had paid to keep a group together that was physically deteriorating. You had paid to keep them together, and that danger of getting old, because that was the fear at that point, was that this group is too old. So it's interesting to come back a couple years later and like, oh, did they mess up? Did they miscalibrate? Earl's still playing pretty well, and Sherman's still an all-pro, let alone... So there was two elements to it of not only the sense in the locker room, because I think mostly that was when it came to Sherman, that was the case, is that do you want someone who thinks he knows best and thinks that your team is on the downslope? Do you want someone that feels that this team has hit its best sell by date?
Yeah. And once you get past that sell by date, there is that lukewarm area where, all right, oh, maybe I could try it. It's somewhat like milk. I mean, sometimes if you have lettuce with a lot of spinach in it, it usually lasts a little bit longer than the expiration date, the bye-bye date. It's not ideal, and it starts to get all that nastiness on it. But I wonder if there was a chance that they could have kept some of those guys around. And as the outside and somewhat skeptic, I don't know if I'm creating a straw army when I feel that I've heard this a lot, but I have gotten this sense that maybe there are some that have their blue and green glasses on, and they're like, you know what? Without Richard Sherman, without Earl Thomas, without Doug Baldwin, this team is better. They're for the better. And I understand from a locker room standpoint, but at the same time, you missed having a definitively number one safety this year without Earl Thomas until you finally stumbled into one in Quandre Diggs. Great job by John Schneider finding Quandre Diggs. You, at the same time, are still trying to find a cornerback opposite Shaquille Griffin. And even with Shaquille Griffin, he's a Pro Bowler, and I'm very happy for him. I still think he is trying to prove himself as a number one corner that at the very least is going to make it difficult for number one wide receiver. You have Richard Sherman, you're beating Green Bay. Like, it's, to me, that's simple. And perhaps I'm looking at it thinking that Richard Sherman would have been able to just swallow that pride and continue to play at the same level. But That's the thing I'm having a weird time getting past is it just feels that there are a lot of people saying, like, this is for the best. And I understand it from the locker room standpoint, but isn't this game played on the field?
Our playoff coverage is brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. It's certainly jarring. If I was going to list the players that the Seahawks missed most that they previously had this year, the regret level, which move did I regret them making the most? Number one is Earl Thomas's departure as a free agent. I think the way that played out and the trickle-down effect that had at safety, that was the most difficult for them to deal with. If they could take a mulligan, that's the one I would do over first. The second is the regret that Doug Baldwin wasn't there. I think that Seattle's offense was still very good. It would have been better with Baldwin.
Imagine Baldwin and Metcalf and Lockett, but you also have to wonder, would Metcalf had turned into the guy that he already has in 1 year if Baldwin's there getting some catches. And I can't speak to this as much as you can, Danny. I don't know what the relationship between Doug Baldwin and Russell Wilson really was. I just know that before I came here, there was a couple of year stretch where I was constantly puzzled seeing random stories about Russell Wilson not really being well-liked by the locker room. And I don't know if Doug Baldwin was a part of that camp. But I can understand why Doug Baldwin might have looked at Russell Wilson, the young pup, as the quarterback, all of a sudden becoming the leader on a team that was once led by the Legion of Boom, and say, oh, hang on a second. Like, I know what I'm doing out here.
I don't think it was the deepest friendship, but I think it was a very productive on-field relationship.
Definitely.
And I think they worked really well together. I don't think that his return, I think it would have been nothing but a benefit. I think they would have been better because of that. Clearly, in a distant third is Sherman, and saying A, missed him just because I think that his presence, where I don't think Doug Baldwin staying on the team would have had any negative impact on the locker room's chemistry or anything like that. I think it's possible that Sherman's could have. I think that it's possible in the 2 years since he's been gone. The other thing that I think is that maybe Sherman wouldn't have been as good if he wasn't so determined to prove the Seahawks wrong. That if he just stays in Seattle and he doesn't have that other, he got to fixate. He thrives off of having an enemy. He thrives off of it to the point where I believe he'll invent an enemy even when one doesn't exist. And that one of the problems in Seattle became that he'd proved everybody else wrong. And then he started thinking he knew better than the guys that were on him. And eventually you're like, no. These guys are on the same side as you. Like, you don't need to prove you're right ahead of your coach. Like, that's actually going to be bad for the overall operation. Sherman thrives on having an antagonist. And in going to San Francisco, and one of the motivations he even said for going to San Francisco was that revenge factor. I think it fueled him, and I think it helped him become a better player over it. I don't think he would have the same kind of recovery had he been in Seattle.
That's fair, but I also think that Richard Sherman is, on this level, a bit of a crazy person when it comes to finding ways to motivate himself. For example, pretending that Baker Mayfield didn't shake his hand this season.
Yes.
He will find ways. He will find ways to motivate himself. It could be simply not feeling as respected as he wanted to here. It could be someone that refused to look him in the eye at a deli in a grocery store. It could be anything.
You're right. And the issue is he was out of the honeymoon period here. San Francisco's still in the honeymoon period with Richard. They're going to get to love to watch it. And this whole next week when he talks, they're going to all love it, and they're going to eat it up, and they're going to forget the fact of what he did on the field 6 years ago after the NFC Championship game, because they're in the honeymoon period. If he's still there 3 years from now, I guarantee there's going to be some angst that he directs at people, that he will run out of people to find motivation from, and the honeymoon period will be over. It'll be someone within his locker room, within his franchise, that he's vocally unhappy with.
I know that this has been a tough week for your group chat because you have been dealing with...
Oh, I stopped talking to them.
Did you put it on mute?
Yeah, no, I haven't. My WhatsApp notifications, I haven't. First,
smart.
I saw that Jeff Bezos, his phone got hacked after he received a WhatsApp.
By a Saudi prince?
By a WhatsApp message from a Saudi prince. And I was like, I don't need that app anymore, and I don't want to hear any more of their Niners garbage, so I'm just not opening that application.
But I know you're thinking right now that when this honeymoon period ends for the 49ers, it's going to be fun to let them know about it. How do you think it happens? How do you think it'll end? Eventually end this honeymoon phase for Richard Sherman in San Francisco?
How do I hope it ends? I hope it ends on Super Bowl Sunday when Tyreek Hill has 5 yards of separation behind Richard Sherman and he starts waving his arms wildly because the safety wasn't over there to help. That's how I hope it ends.
We saw it against Andy Isabella earlier this year against the Cardinals.
That's how I hope it ends, is that they're down by 20 points in the Super Bowl and we start to see the spontaneous combustion, and you never know when it's going to come. And once it starts, we've seen it twice on the sidelines in Seahawks games where he's kind of just lost his mind. And one of those times was his fault. It was his fault. It was his assignment that got blown, and he ended up melting down against the Atlanta Falcons. It is Danny and Gallant. It's now time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
Jess.
What's going on? Speaking of exceptional, I didn't let you answer. My bad, Danny.
No, go ahead. Continue through.
Two quarterbacks get together as Tom Brady joins the latest episode of Peyton's Places, and we have a preview.
I miss the old dome. The old dome had
it was so good.
It was so loud.
And you couldn't hear anything.
Yeah, we didn't pump in noise either. So.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, no, I never saw it.
No comment. What is that here? You guys are like scoping our own? Is there a locker room? Are you guys that paranoid?
I'm doing the interview.
I couldn't believe that. No, I got a few things to get off my chest.
It's not called Tom's Places.
We had warm Gatorade or something in your locker room, and everyone got mad, and we bugged the locker room or something. I mean,
talk to my coaches in the shower. I'm like, I don't want to see Howard Mudd in the shower.
Howard Mudd lives around here.
Wow. I mean, I can't wait. That is... Jess, that's fantastic audio. I can't wait for this.
It's going to be a good episode.
What do you think the conversation is like between them? They won't air this part. If Tom was going to ask him about what it's like to leave the team that you've been the franchise quarterback for, what do you think Peyton's honest advice would be about that?
I think that he would say that he felt a sense of bitterness over the way that things ended in Indianapolis, and that it actually did motivate him to have the kind of success that he did have with the Denver Broncos. And you know what? To the Colts' credit, the guy's neck was, like, not connected to his head anymore, essentially. Like, that's the injury that he was dealing with. I can understand why the Colts had their reservations about it. But those kind of reservations, which the Patriots probably have about paying Tom Brady that kind of salary going forward, they could be a motivating fuel. And I bet that would be the conversation about, like, what was your feeling and how much did it drive you? And I am really curious as to what happens next for Tom Brady. I'm still having a hard time thinking that Tom Brady would be able to tolerate a non-Patriots NFL organization. There are some organizations that are well-run. Maybe Indianapolis is actually a team that he ends up going to. He would have to get over the whole Deflategate thing, but I am very curious as to what happens next with him. And you know what, Danny? That's a fantastic place to be a fly on the wall for. Between those two about their future.
If I was Tom Brady, here's the question I would ask Peyton. How satisfying was that second Super Bowl? He wasn't the same player, but he won his second Super Bowl. How satisfying was that for you, and was that as satisfying as your first Super Bowl? Because I could see that being something of like, yeah, I was able to do this elsewhere. This wasn't just about me being on a cog in that wheel, in that machine. That it was you can trace it to me as well.
There's definitely some of that, and I know... The competitor in Tom Brady wants to compete against everyone, and while he might not be adversarial in the locker room a la Richard Sherman, you know he wants to ultimately have something to hold over Bill Belichick when it's all said and done. And who wouldn't, by the way? Who wouldn't have that mindset?
Everybody wants to show their boss that they know best.
Exactly.
I don't know if it'll be as entertaining, but J.J. Watt is scheduled to host Saturday Night Live the night before the Super Bowl.
Is he funny?
This is something that we have to figure out. Here's the big thing for JJ, the big development. In my time covering JJ Watt, at first, the superhero act was tiresome for a lot of people. Then he actually followed through and did some really amazing things in the city of Houston. But what's been great for him recently is I think he is so much more self-aware than he used to be. Because I don't think he had any self-awareness back in the day. But over time, I think he has become more frank and more honest. And there's always going to be a corniness with him. Maybe that's just part of going to Wisconsin. But with J.J. Watt. I'm intrigued. If we have a scale of what he's going to be asked to do, it's interesting we just mentioned Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning, I think they asked him to do a whole lot more on Saturday Night Live than Tom Brady did. I wonder what they will ask him to do.
Did any of us think that Eli Manning was going to be that funny? And then, wow.
It's a face. Like the face I was making at the time, like I was winking, but also sticking my tongue out.
Did you just say that Peyton Manning got a better role than Tom Brady, and that was the reason he was more entertaining, and not the fact that Tom Brady is bland, boring?
Listen, it's when you're handsome, it's hard to be funny. And Peyton Manning's forehead.
You said that they wrote him better than they wrote Tom Brady, and that's why he was more entertaining.
I mean, one of Brady's skits was essentially him just standing in his underwear, and it was like what to the do's and don'ts of sexual harassment in the workplace. He didn't even talk in that skit. It was just him and Tidy Whiteys.
Because I'm not from Boston. I'm from California.
That wasn't funny.
Danny's laughing.
He was laughing because I'm funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Apparently, Matt LaFleur is still working through his decision on whether or not to hire Mike Pettine.
Mike Pettine did not think Russell Wilson was a top 10 quarterback after he won the Super Bowl. Mike Pettine did not think that Russell Wilson was one of the elite quarterbacks in the game the year after he had the number one passer rate, the year he had the number one passer rating in the league. So maybe Mike Pettine's not great at knowing who's good at quarterback, how to stop a quarterback.
Or when another team's running right over you, not putting an eighth defender up in the box to stop the run. Honestly, if your defense gets beat in the NFC Championship game by an opponent that is forced to pass only eight times, like at that point, isn't that like do something different?
Right.
Is that fireable?
I think it is, and this is the funny thing about Green Bay. Like, their defense, I think, overachieved this past season. I think that what they got out of their front seven, in particular Za'Darius Smith, I thought was something else. But they were so hopeless against the run. And if that's an all-season-long kind of theme for a team that overachieved just as much as the Seahawks did, you could definitely say it's a fireable offense.
Here's the danger in what you just said. Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith were two big budget additions in the offseason that everybody praised how well the Packers addressed their biggest deficiency. And we saw just how far it got them and the fact that defense might have overachieved. It's really hard to solve big defensive problems in free agency, even when you spend a ton of money. That's something we should all keep in mind. It is Danny and Gallant. We've been giving you a day-by-day guide. We're fixing the NFL. One rule change at a time. We started out, we got rid of the invisible plane, right? You actually have to touch down in the end zone to score a touchdown. No more of the boop, oh, the nose of the ball across the invisible plane, touchdown. Yesterday, there were two additions, one of which was the elimination of illegal contact downfield. The second one, which was probably more interesting, which certainly made me laugh more, was quarterbacks, running backs, and wide receivers can no longer give themselves up. They can't slide. They can't slide to get out of a hit. Like, if you're in the middle of the field and you can't say, no, don't hit me. You have to be hit.
Exactly. Or go out of bounds if you don't want to be hit. Find a way to get out of bounds. Get off the field.
The next one, well, we'll tell you what that is next on Danny and Gallant.
Kill.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
We're fixing football. We're doing it one rule change at a time. We've gotten three that we've put in place that I feel pretty good about. Can't score a touchdown by just poking the nose of the football over the invisible plane that is the goal line. You actually have to touch down in the end zone, which somebody's pointed out that Peyton's Place has actually said is one of the original rules. We're going to eliminate illegal contact downfield. You can shove before the ball's in the air. You can rough guys up all you want, right?
Yes.
And then the third one is there will be no more baseball slides or otherwise giving yourself up. If you are a ball carrier and have the ball, you are alive until you either are tackled or go out of bounds.
Yes. So
you can't say, no, don't hit me.
Right. If you don't want to be hit, run out of bounds. And if you don't get out of bounds, 5-yard penalty every single time.
All right. Jessamyn McIntyre is up next. Jessamyn, how are you going to save football?
Well, I'm changing, and I should be clear, this is not football, this is the NFL, because it does exist. The rule I want changed does exist at the college ranks. The spot foul on pass interference needs to go. I just don't think that you should be able to huck it up in the air 80 yards and not have a catch and get 80 yards. 15 yards, I'm okay with. I think it goes well in college football. I don't think it's egregious. I do think that pass interference should continue to be a rule, and I know everyone who's in the trenches is going to get mad at me for saying this because I also have an issue with holding at the line of scrimmage. I don't think that that should be a penalty either, but I do think that the defensive pass interference going for however many yards spot of the foul is more egregious in the NFL, and that's what I would change.
The one, and I agree with you, Jess. I think the one drawback is if a wide receiver burns a defensive back, and we were taught this in high school, if a guy gets by you, just bring him down. Because the worst thing that's going to happen is a 15-yard penalty. Right. So that's one area where it could be a drawback. But I am with you in the from the standpoint of, especially, we are seeing a rash of underthrows being rewarded because defensive backs are doing what they're taught, turning their hips, and running and keeping their eye on the wide receiver until they had to turn around to eventually track a football. And now if a ball is underthrown, the defensive back is helpless because of a poor throw. That shouldn't be the case. The quarterback can't make a throw. A defensive back should be penalized for having good position on a wide receiver who's trying to come back for the ball. It's totally unfair.
I agree with the eliminating the spot foul, because the argument against it is what you just said, Paul, is that it's going to take touchdowns off the board or eliminate 50 or 60 yard receptions, because a defensive back is going to make a cost benefit analysis and say,
yeah,
this guy's behind me, better to give up 15 yards than risk getting beat deep for a touchdown. I don't think in practice that that's what happens in college football. And I don't think changing the rule is going to create a rash of 15-yard penalties. I don't think the incidence of pass interference is going to go up in the NFL because it's less penalized, because there's not as severe a penalty. The fact that a penalty for pass interference is rewarded with a worst-case scenario, as if the ball were to be completed, is one of the things that tilts the game in the offense's favor. It's crazy. And the point that you made, I don't know how to get around rewarding the underthrown ball. I agree with you. It shouldn't get rewarded. I don't know how to get around it other than to say that the referees need to use more discretion.
I think so.
And the way it is, they're already being asked to differentiate between so much that I think we've reached the point of diminishing returns. If you ask them to start parsing plays further, we're going to get more mistakes. That's firmly what I believe. That you, if you ask them, if the ball's underthrown, because basically here's how the rule, how that play is officiated. If the defensive back has his head turned and is looking the ball, is not just watching, there's a little bit of contact that's allowed. You're allowed to hand fight. If you're not looking at the ball, if you're just staring at the receiver, you're not supposed to touch him. And what that's to do is to eliminate the technique where the player doesn't play the ball at all, and he just does subtle little things to prevent the receiver from catching it. It's saying, no, if you're playing the ball, we'll give you a little latitude. If you're not playing the ball, you don't get that latitude. And consequently, the underthrown ball gets rewarded because the guy's head's not around. The receiver's trying to fight through him to get to the ball. And they're like, well, that's a foul because you kept him from getting to the ball. He's like, the ball was underthrown. The ball was underthrown.
Right. And man.
That should fall into the uncatchable category, though, right? Do they have discretion on an underthrown ball like they do an overthrown ball? Because I always felt like they did.
You know what, Jess? It's the same. It's basically the same thing. Because if the defensive back has good position, then yeah, the receiver should be able to get to the ball. So maybe it should be uncatchable in that situation, because all of a sudden you're asking a wide receiver to change his forward momentum to stop and then come back to the ball. That's practically impossible in most cases. And Danny, to your point, yeah, to add more parsing to these guys. I mean, Jerome Boger can't even remember the rules. So now we're going to ask these guys to actually use discretion every single play. Certain crews are going to be able to handle it, but I would venture to say that it's not the majority.
Are you guys okay with how games have been called in the playoffs? Because I think whether the league's going to acknowledge it or not, we're moving closer and closer to there being a direct communication between the referee on the field and the office in New York. I don't think they've acknowledged that that happens. I believe it does. And it's certainly happening now where you have that other official that's on the sidelines in the jacket who comes on. And he was the one that came on and told Corrente that when he awarded the touchdown to Buffalo after the Houston guy didn't signal for fair catch, flipped the ball over there and said it was a live ball. We're getting closer and closer to that of them being able to react. In theory, that should allow officials to correct mistakes quickly, kind of before they become an actual call. In practice, I think it might just completely eliminate any authority that the on-field referee has. And that creates problems, too, when he's not allowed to officiate. He's just going to be told what to call by the big boss back in New York.
Yeah, and that's, if that's where you are, that's bad, obviously. And look, I think there's also a little bit of conspiracy. And I don't know if you saw this conspiracy coming out of Tennessee. There was a 3rd-and-1 play in the Titans-Chiefs game, and people are fixated on a referee who, maybe because it's cold, had his right hand in his pocket. And as a snap begins, before the play has even really started, he is pulling a flag out to throw it. People have gone nuts over this, specifically in Tennessee.
I think he throws it as the ball is snapped, and
right.
Holding ends up getting called on the play.
Right, and I think that goes a little bit further to the idea that the people upstairs are maybe seeing something that isn't actually there. It was a 3rd-and-1 for Tennessee in that spot. Is the NFL Illuminati trying to keep the Titans out of the Super Bowl?
There's no way that holding could have occurred yet.
Right.
The play had just started, and he threw it. Yeah, I think I'd go pretty nuts if I was a Tennessee fan and I saw that.
I
don't know what the response or explanation could be that a flag was thrown, unless it was he thought it was a formation penalty.
That's what people think, and it was picked up for the illegal formation. And I think someone else might have thrown a flag for holding, and I think that's how these things start. It's just one person putting it out there, and it blows up, and it becomes that. But I think there is a general mistrust when it comes to referees. And honestly, it's fair. These guys are not as on top of the rule book as they should be. And that's the bare minimum. That is what you're supposed to be in charge of. I am strongly convinced, Danny, that Jerome Boger does not know all the rules. And we have seen it a couple of times with him. That's just one. I'm sure you could point at other ones and say, oh, this guy does not have a firm grasp on the entire rule book. Maybe they all need to sit down in front of Mike Tirico and Bill Belichick or something like that and have them teach the rules to him. But that's a part of it. And if you do add in the idea of like the sky judge having more power and all of that, well, this is going to go in a direction where some fans probably don't want it to go. And there will definitely be more conspiracy theories than we've already been dealing with.
There's a paradox here in that the more we try to get calls accurate, the more we're fixating on the mistakes. I firmly believe that officiating today and the way games are called is way more accurate than it was 15 to 20 years ago. I also believe that we fixate on the unfairness of mistakes that are currently made way more than we did 15 to 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this contrast of the officiating. I don't think the officiating is worse. I think the actual correct, the percentage of calls that are gotten correct is higher, and it might even be significantly higher, but the amount of angst that we spend complaining about the calls that they get wrong is way significantly higher, even though there's fewer of them. Because you would think that the more accurate you get it, the more you're like, well, it's better than it used to be. The exact opposite is happening.
Right.
We're becoming more indignant about the mistakes that are made, even as less mistakes are being made.
And that's I feel, a result of all of these cameras and all of these HD ability to zoom in and see minutia that, let's be honest, and I don't want to sound ageist here, but most of these refs are like 55 years old. let's be honest about their eyesight. Is it great? Probably not.
Should they have to go through a combine each and every year? You'd have the NFL referees combine to see if you're still up to snuff. I have a friend, and he's a very good friend of mine who is a surgeon and a legitimate spinal surgeon, and he asserts that doctors should have to go through a combine.
Definitely.
to measure their dexterity each year with the things, because he's like, these guys become doctors and nobody's been watching them do surgery for 20 years. They just do it. Like, some of them are bad. I'm telling you, some of them are bad.
We could go further with this. Like, if you, there's a certain point where everyone needs to have their driving skills re-examined. and no one does it.
Okay, we're going to get out of this before you alienate half of our audience from the 253. A paradox? Danny, a paradox? The type of paradox that disrupts the space-time continuum and ends the universe as we know it? Yes, exactly. That kind of paradox. We throw flags next on Danny and Gallant.
From the pocket, and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It is Danny and Gallant. This is the time we all gather together. We get in a huddle. Maybe we have an earpiece where we talk to the sky judge and assess what went right, what went wrong, what needs to be challenged, and what needs to be praised.
Need to know about the sky judge, Danny.
The sky judge? Oh,
don't
that's
tell
you.
Him.
Is that the new Illuminati?
Yeah, the new Illuminati.
I am
no,
the
you
Illuminati.
Can't do that. Yeah. let's let the Illuminati start first. Jess.
All right. I got a flag to raise. It is, you know, I like to raise him more than throw him. For Josh Gordon, great to see him out and enjoying the Pacific Northwest, although he is publicizing it to all the outsiders quite a bit, so they might end up coming here. But it was nice to see him say how, even though the weather's bad, it's one of the most beautiful places he's seen. I think it's a really good sign for him on a personal level that he stayed here, which was a new place to him. It says to me that he has a support system here, and I was just glad to see him back on social media, not dark anymore. I think that's a positive sign. So raising a flag for him and his future.
I wonder how the NFL handles whatever punishment they probably will give to him, because I think it's important to note that last year when he violated the NFL's policy, they did not suspend him for a long period of time. They just suspended him essentially, I think, the rest of the regular season, and he was ready to go early on for the Patriots. And I think there were a lot of people across the NFL that thought it was kind of unfair that Josh Gordon was able to go at the start of the season for New England. I wonder if it's handled the same way this offseason, because I think Roger Goodell's taken Josh Gordon on as a bit of a pet project and seems to have some affinity for him for whatever reason. And maybe it's just because he seems to be a very nice guy. Whatever the case, there might be a chance that he has the ability to play for the Seahawks next season. And that, I am more intrigued by that than perhaps anything this offseason.
Does it matter to you what drug he used?
I have a feeling that it probably was something a little bit more intense than marijuana. I think that's been...
Because that's what I was just going to say. If it's weed, I really...
I don't care.
Yeah,
but that
all.
Makes me think why Roger Goodell might not be going so harsh on him, because the NFL is taking a turn when it comes to cannabis and marijuana products, and it sounds like that might change in the near future. That's why I guess I was hoping upon hope that it was only that, because it was that and performance-enhancing drugs, but a lot of the things that are said to be performance-enhancing drugs are actually things that mask marijuana. And, maybe, I have a best-case scenario for everything, and in my head, is the best of a worst-case scenario, is that that's what he was using, and that's why Roger Goodell did not come down hard on him.
I think also for him, and I hope he stays here, because it does seem like the Seahawks, specifically Russell Wilson, they really like him. I think for someone that's going through something like this, it's so important to have a group of people as a support system. And especially a group of people as a support system that maybe have you far away from home where you can fall back into your worst habits. So he's away from Texas now. And I really do hope it works out for him. I do think it has the potential to, especially if the Seahawks are allowed to basically stay in contact with them, which with the suspensions they would not be.
Lydia Cruz, flags.
I'm going to throw a flag today, Paul. I'm sorry to do it, but it's flag football related.
Here's the deal. So last night, played in a flag football game in basically a cold monsoon. It was about 44 degrees. It was a miserable experience. And Bob, you played. I can imagine that you had that same kind of feeling, because at the very least for me, I was moving the whole time. When you're on one side of the ball, you probably have to stand there awkwardly, getting colder and colder and colder.
So here's the thing. You kind of almost insulted Bump, not intentionally. Like, it must have been colder or harder for you, Bump, because I play both sides of the ball, so I'm on the field all the time.
No, I mean...
Bummer for you.
Oh, gosh. I was trying to highlight my general weeniness. Because, all right, in 2003.
Be a game breaker like me, Bump. This won't be a problem.
It had to be harder for you because you didn't even play defense. Me, I was out there covering tools.
Yikes.
Listen, that was not my intent at all. All I will say is that I once was in that situation because I was bad at football in middle school. I was not good. I was tiny. I was one of the smallest players on the team. Barely got to play. I remember playing in a game against, I forget, I think it was like some really preppy sounding New England school. It was 40 degrees, just raining the whole time. I've never been more miserable. It was awful. Except because you're not moving at all. Like, that's... I do wonder, for the guys that do play in those really cold, rainy games, and you're just on the sideline, like, you better have one of those giant parkas available for you so you don't get soaked.
Paul, your flags.
I'm just gonna throw a flag on the cold monsoon weather that we had last night. So that's my first time just being out in that for an extended period of time. I will say this, Seattle, you guys have done fantastic from a weather perspective for the last 4 months. Like, it really, there've been some clouds, but I have been impressed by the lack of rain compared to my expectations. But last night, that was awful. That was awful.
Was it sideways?
Yeah, it was at times. It was a lot. It was intense.
It lets you know when it's here.
It really does.
It's raining right on my face.
Danny.
My flag is going to be thrown on whoever from Kansas State got mad and took exception to D'Souza stuffing the guy that tried for a lay-in.
Yeah.
There are rules in basketball. You get dunked on or you get blocked, you take it. Like Frederick Weiss, when Vince Carter jumped over him, you didn't be like, oh, you showed me. Yeah, you just got dunked on. You eat that. You're going to have to hold that one. And when you steal the ball, it's the clock's running out, and you lay down and you get capped, like you get absolutely stuffed and looked at dismissively, you have to hold that one. And whoever got mad about it, you're being a baby and you broke the rules of conduct. And I'm not saying you should have gotten punched, but you should not have started the fight.
I'm with you 100%. I mean, you lost. And, you know, back in ancient times when you were conquered, you know what they used to do? They used to kill you, put your head on a spike. So sit there, be conquered, and move on to the next game. Lydia doesn't like that.
That went a little dark. And, yeah.
That's going to do it for us today. I want to thank Nick Rolovich for coming aboard. That was really fun to meet Washington State's new head coach. Jessamine and Lydia are always the beacons of brightness in this morning voyage. He's Paul Gallant, and he's going to have to look out for falling iguanas as he goes to the frozen tundra of Miami, Florida.
The frozen tundra of Miami, Florida. You're so right. Gosh, that's terrifying. He's Danny O'Neill, and when he swats you, all 5'7" of him will stand over you and look down upon what he has rained upon you. So long, farewell, until we meet again, peeps.
It was just so much fun.